Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Dave and Gabriel get together probably once a month, sometimes to watch a hockey game, or just to eat and drink, or they go fishing. Gabriel was flattered when Dave came to him for a sympathetic ear just after his divorce. It was such a novelty for Gabriel. Men rarely thought of him as someone they could talk to. People tended to set him above themselves, but not Dave, who thought of Gabriel as a slightly retarded brother due to his inexperience in the woods. That first night he came to the house, Dave was so drunk, it was a wonder he arrived at all. Gabriel kept getting up, following him around, ready to catch him if he fell. He sniffed and stumbled around the kitchen, telling Gabriel how sad he was when he looked out the kitchen window at his lonely compost heap, and how bare and forlorn the spot on the counter was where she used to keep her juicer. He moaned over his poor lonely bed, the poor lonely chair, everything lonely and bare and empty. His repetition made Gabriel think of a children's story. Then suddenly, Dave wanted to go home, though he could barely stand up. He said he would hurry right back, that he needed to get his Dylan collection. He just had to play the String Bean Song for Gabriel. Gabriel suggested that Dave sit down on the couch in the living room for a minute first, which he did, and immediately slumped over and fell asleep. Dave had pretty much adjusted to living by himself after about a year, and he and Gabriel were quite good friends by then. Gabriel looked forward to seeing Dave, who was a very accepting person, as was Tia, but everyone had their limits, apparently. She still cared about him and would ask Gabriel how Dave was doing over a bunch of beets or whatever he was buying at the health food store. Gabriel shopped for groceries intuitively as he chose music according to what his body craved. Or was it his spirit? Could a spirit crave beets, spinach, oat bran? As most dancers, he had always been careful about his physical self, and although he occasionally ate meat, it was never more than a few times a year, and he would feel renewed afterward, such as tonight after the duck dinner. But he knew tomorrow he would feel heavy and leaden and wouldn't be able to dance. Dave had brought him out of the dance studio and out into nature. He took him down the lake to see eagles taking off from their nests. They watched with binoculars as the birds rose into the sky, their powerful wings flapping slowly, surprisingly slowly, to rise upward. They took their time. He learned from them. Now Gabriel has his own motorboat, an old wooden rowboat, and a red canoe. He takes long trips down White Deer Lake by himself, docks his boat at a lodge 10 miles down the lake, where he stores his canoe, then canoes along the lake edge about a half mile, to his favorite lake, which is actually a bay, Apollo Bay, which Dave tells him is officially Turtle Bay. The left side of the bay is covered with white water lilies, where he's seen moose wading and nibbling their lunch. He has his own rock where he eats his lunch. It's next to a sand beach where he can easily pull in the canoe, and the rock slopes down to the lake and points to a tiny island where blueberries grow. On his rock, he can sleep in the sun, watch the turtles sunning on logs and boulders in the bay, or watch geese and ducks and other birds come and go. Sometimes he swims, trying not to think about the snapping turtles. There is rarely anyone on this part of the lake, and only once has he encountered anyone in the bay. And then just a couple of fishermen, who soon left because of the turtles. No one likes the nasty experience of hooking a turtle, Dave told him. Gabriel is almost home. The drive from Dave's always goes by fast. When he pulls into the driveway, he sees Jennifer's Volkswagen bus sitting by his garage. She's done this before, but not in such cold weather, and it scares him. What if she's fallen asleep with the motor on? He's relieved to see her get out of the car and wave at him. He drives into the garage slowly, hoping he can send her on her way without a scene. It's 2:10 a.m. and he is dead tired. Sleepless nights after the acupuncture must be catching up with him. Jennifer is a clumsy dancer, too big really, but she works hard and loves ballet with a genuine passion. Gabriel enjoys working with her as a student. If only she would leave it at that. He dreads these encounters and tries hard to remain aloof and professional on the one hand, while on the other, knowing it's an absolute necessity to be warm and encouraging with his young students. The sheer physicality of ballet brings emotions to the surface, and he knows it's important to be careful, to be thoughtful of their youthful sensitivities. Before he taught, he could handle the advances of women. It was either yes or no. They were on equal footing. He knows he is a good teacher and brings out the best in each student. If they would just stop falling for him. "Mr. Perez, I thought you might be lonely. It's such a cold night. Don't look at me like that. Am I so bad? I'm too ugly. You don't like me," Jennifer says, covering her face with her mittened hands, already starting to cry before Gabriel has said a word. "No, please don't call my mother. I know you're going to call my mother." "Jennifer, come inside. It's cold. Now there's no reason to cry," he says. She's so lovely under the porch light, bundled up in a big down parka, her complexion so baby soft. Gabriel would love to carry her inside and up to his bed, lose himself in her sweet softness. But they go inside and Gabriel calls her mother and tells him to keep her there. "Don't let her drive. We'll be right out. Be there in 10 minutes, Jennifer's mother says. "Her dad will drive the bug and Jennifer will ride in the pickup with me." "Well, they're on their way," he says, hanging up the phone. "Tea?" Gabriel heats water for tea, while Jennifer sits at the table, dabbing at her eyes and nose with a tissue. "I'm flattered, Jennifer," he says, "but first of all, I'm your teacher, and second, I'm too old for you. You should be dating someone in your class. What are you this year? Aren't you a sophomore?" "Junior," she says. She stopped crying now, but is quite sullen. "And most important, I care about you. That's why I called your folks," he says. They sip chamomile tea and wait for her parents. Gabriel asks about her classes, her interests aside from ballet. "I'm interested in you," she says matter-of-factly. "Besides that, what else do you like?" "Well, they're doing this play at school, 10 Little Indians. Officially, they call it, and then there were none, because that's more correct, you know. But it's a murder mystery. I haven't told anyone yet," she leans toward him confidentially. "But I was thinking of trying out." Gabriel nods, watching her shy enthusiasm, thinking she could well use something like that, a second artistic outlet for her passionate nature. "My speech teacher last year said I have the voice for it. She says I project very well." "Yes, you have a strong voice. Do it, Jenny. I think it's a great idea. When are auditions?" "Tomorrow after school." "Heavens, and here you are up this late?" "Here they are," he says, hearing the pickup come down the drive. "Oh, Lord, the last time I came out here in September when it rained, she took the bug away for a month. What will she do?" "What do you think she'll do?" he asks. "My dad won't say anything, and my mom will glare. She glares so hard it looks like her face will crack off like in The Mummy. You know that movie? That's one of my favorites. Oh, I love when Boris Karloff chants in ancient Egyptian. Oh," she says, now quite happy and awake. "Mostly, they just yell at each other, blame each other for me being bad. They'll say things like, 'What kind of example are you? And where were you in September? And okay, Queen Elizabeth, since you know it all, you handle it. She's laughing now. Gabriel opens the door and quietly tells her parents she just wanted to talk about school, that they really shouldn't be too hard on her. He clicks off the porch light after they drive out of sight, and soon he is in bed. 10 seconds after his head hits the pillow, he's sound asleep. Chapter 8. Fawn and Greta are spending a second night in Thunder Bay. The weather report is for blizzard conditions all day, with increasing snow to the north and expected to taper off during the night. They both spent the afternoon at the craft shop, except for Greta's hour down the street at Dr. Winkle's. Tonight they are at Dorothy's again. She closed the cafe early because of the storm and dropped off a mason jar of hot stew for Ernie at his apartment above Joe's Corner Drug. Dorothy clicks off the TV after the late weather report. Her husband Ron, who teaches driver's training and directs the chorus at the high school, has gone to bed early with a sore throat, and the women are lounging around the TV. Greta and Fawn are in borrowed robes, and the lace in Greta's robe is scratching her neck. The lace makes it seem that the robe hasn't been worn, but otherwise it's soft and cozy. Hot chocolate? Dorothy asks. They all want some. With or without amaretto? With, it's unanimous. Dorothy arrives with a tray of mugs of hot chocolate, plus a bottle of amaretto and a scissors. I'll cut off that lace. I should have done it when I got it, 2 years ago, Dorothy says. Greta slips off the robe and Dorothy clips off the lace. Sometimes I save things for a special occasion, like a trip to Mars. I'll crochet a pink cotton board or something with nice soft cotton, she says, handing back the robe. Soon they've finished the hot chocolate and are sipping straight amaretto from their mugs. Greta has passed along on Ruth's gardening tips. Spread wood ashes around the cabbages to keep away the slugs. Be sure to dry raspberry leaves thoroughly before using for tea, or you might be poisoned. And Ruth's medicinal advice, never eat those little silver things used to decorate cakes. They cause diabetes, cancer, and epilepsy. Good grief, she even knows what causes cancer, Fawn laughs, stretching her legs out on the coffee table. Greta enjoys telling Fawn and Dorothy about her session with Dr. Winkle. She told them she went to him because she's been having terrible nightmares. She hasn't mentioned Gabriel. Dorothy says she was probably the only patient Dr. Winkle has seen in months. She knows him from her trips to his brother, Dr. Ted Winkle, the dentist. The shrink, Dr. Winkle, comes through the inner office door and acts like he's the dental assistant, Dorothy tells them. He hands Ted Winkle dental tools occasionally, but mostly he just comes to watch. And Dr. Ted is always saying things like, "Back, Willie. Not so close, Willie." Fawn and Greta both laugh, saying "Willy Winkle" at the same time, while trying to be quiet since Ron is sleeping in the next room. And to think he's my first customer in Thunder Bay. He practically followed me back to the co-op and bought the Swan Lake piece from the front window, Greta says. And also returned your check, Fawn says. That's probably how he gets away with it. He doesn't accept money, so no one is likely to complain. He did have a certificate on the wall, Greta says, thinking of how nice the colored glass Swan Lake hanging looked in the craft store window in the bright snow light. And she wonders where Dr. Winkle will hang it in his office. Probably in the back window. I suppose you could say he has an unusual technique. Who knows, maybe he's a genius, Greta says. Not too likely, Dorothy says on her way into the kitchen with a tray of mugs balanced on one hand. And how could anyone be sure about the guy? I mean, people who go to him are the ones with the problems, Greta says. What kind of discrimination are they going to have? They're probably not very sure of their own opinions, or they wouldn't be seeing him. Well, let's all say goodnight to Wee Willie Winkie. I've got deliveries coming in at 6:30 in the morning. The milk truck never came today. And I've got eggs coming in, too. Plus, I have pies to bake. Dorothy knows she can count on Ernie to be there early shoveling her out, so she'll open for breakfast. It's 11 o'clock when they pull out the hide-a-bed and roll away. Greta and Fawn plan to leave early in the morning, too. The sky is cleared, so the road should be plowed and sanded by morning. Greta is going to send Dorothy the dimensions of her bedroom window so she can crochet curtains for her in exchange for a stained glass piece featuring fruit. Greta falls asleep with images of grapes and oranges and coal, almost sure that she'll sleep through the night with peaceful dreams. The pale early morning sun is marked by the cold weather halo of the sundog, and the land is beautiful under a fresh blanket of snow. Drifts well up against the hills and barns, in haystacks, and fence posts are topped with tall white mounds of snow. Greta's roof has a poor slant. She'll have to get out the ladder and scrape snow from the old pole after digging through the inevitable drift she'll face at her front door. She hopes Karloff can get out this morning, plow her driveway. He'll do Fawn's, too, if he can get out, but her place is never as bad as Greta's. Fawn's house is surrounded by thick firs and has little cleared space, which is fine in winter, but in summer it's thick with mosquitoes. Greta wiggles her toes, pleased with her new boots, which are fleece-lined and come right up to her knees. She had them conditioned with mink oil right in the store. Her old boots would have lasted another couple of years if a mouse family hadn't moved into her left boot in late summer. She won't leave these boots out in the shed. Fawn reminded her that your boots can save your life up here. Your boots are your life, she said. While she was trying on boots in Thunder Bay, Greta kept picturing Millie's four-toed foot in the sauna, so she chose the warmest and most practical pair, not the most expensive, but nearly so. Millie lost her toe to frostbite as a child, walking home from school on a bitter cold day. She was wearing boots, but with thin cotton socks that offered little protection against a surprise October snowstorm. Luckily, she had brought her new Angora birthday muff for show and tell. Otherwise, she would likely have lost fingers as well as the toe. Millie always tells how Alan, a boy in her class, brought his father's glass eye for show and tell that day, somehow making it seem the two calamities were connected, the loss of the toe and the missing eye. Millie hadn't liked the way some of her schoolmates wanted to touch the eye. She worried about Alan's father. What if they broke it? No one asked what he was doing that day with his eye at school, and it troubled her. In fact, that's what she kept thinking about when she was in the hospital. Millie had told the story recently in the sauna, though they had all heard the story a number of times before. She always talked about it as though it happened just a month or so ago, rather than 60 years past. Tilly is the one who tells them, rather guiltily, it seems to Greta, that she had been home with a bad cold that day. Fran has said little since they left Thunder Bay. She is a good listener, a serious person. Greta admires her Garbo-esque profile and her short, silky gray hair, which she sets off with richly colored hand-woven shawls and sweaters. She wears the same silver arrow earrings most every day. Fawn grew up in Toronto, studied theater design, and married Mitchell Lake, a cardiologist, who died of a heart attack in his early 40s. She then took up knitting, joined a sewing club with her daughter Monique, who died in a horrendous car train wreck 7 years ago, after which Fawn moved to Red Otter, bought a house on the lake, and a loom. Fawn turns off the radio and asks Greta to find a tape in the glove department. Ghost Stories by Robertson Davies, The Plow That Broke the Plains, or National Anthems of the World. Or wait, this one. Film music by Nina Roto, Side 1, French music side too, she reads from the label. French film music, Fawn says. Okay with you? Sure, she says, sliding it into the old tape player. By the time they reach Red Otter, they have listened to all of the tapes, including the ghost stories, and are on a second hearing of the film music from France when they stop at Don's grocery, pulling in just before the store closes for the day. They buy the bare necessities, bread, milk, and fruit, plus ice cream. Jean Moreau is singing Le Tourbillon from Jules and Jim when they make the turn off to the lake. They've received more snow than Thunder Bay, and it's piled all the way up to the blue letters on Fawn's mailbox. Route 9, F Lake. Fawn steps out and scoops out the mail, which she tosses into the back seat. They're both relieved to see Fawn's drive has been plowed, which means Karloff has been around and Greta's drive will have been plowed too. Fawn drives past the Hansons. They can hear Tom Hansen out chopping wood. Greta's cabin is the last one on the road before the woods. Halfway down Greta's driveway, Fawn stops the car. What is it? Greta asks. I don't know. I have a funny feeling, Fawn says.
We've been listening to episode 4 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband Robert Ellis on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Today we'll be hearing Prelude No. 1 and Nocturne No. 11, both by Gabrielle Fauré. Thank you.
Thank you.